Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Boy, do I remember this billboard. So does everybody, Anna.
Morning, Bob. Yeah, how could you forget the Dennis Rodman billboard on the side of the Kennedy? If you think your traffic problems are bad this morning, just imagine if you put that billboard back up, how much time you'd add to your commute. It was crazy. A men's clothing store, Bigsby and Crothers, painted that image of Rodman and the Bulls on a billboard on the side of the Kennedy, and it snarled traffic. The whole town was talking about it. And it's interesting because even IDOT took a look at it, and they determined that that one sign alone or one billboard added 30 to 40 minutes to the commute on some days. It was 30 feet tall, 72 feet wide, just this ginormous spectacle. And remember they'd change his hair every time? They painted it every time Rodman got a new hair color? Which was all the time, and that did not help Bob, by the way, because the traffic times got worse. The people who had seen it already stopped again to see it and take pictures and that kind of thing. And at this point in time, think back to the Bulls. Rodman was serving a 6-game suspension for headbutting a ref during a game. And so he came back to the game then with fire engine red hair, and they changed it again. So at that point, there were accidents and more talk about how it maybe isn't safe even to have that billboard up. So Bigsby and Crothers took the billboard down, and there you go. It's the shortest lived and most talked about billboard maybe in Chicago history.
The Bulls. Yes.
At one point on a Saturday, traffic was backed up for 12 miles, and Bigsby and Crothers wisely decided they didn't want to be associated with angry motorists.
Yeah, they're like, it's time to take it down.
On the Oscars, we saw Chicago's Daryl Hannah, and this was a big week for her in 1978, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1978, Chicago native Daryl Hannah got her big break, Bob. This was the role that landed her a spot in Hollywood and a lot of attention. She was 17 years old and cast in Brian De Palma's The Fury. It was a horror movie, but a critically acclaimed one with a lot of big names attached to it. And that led to get a lot of attention in Hollywood. She worked with Ridley Scott and Oliver Stone within a short time after that. By the age of 23, she was cast in the lead role as a mermaid, as the mermaid in Splash opposite Tom Hanks. Anyone who's seen that could never forget that movie. But back when she was growing up, Bob, this is interesting, in Chicago, no one thought any of that was possible. Daryl Hannah was extremely shy, very withdrawn. She was ostracized by her classmates and diagnosed with autism. She said that it was recommended that she be medicated and even placed in a facility for kids with special needs. And her mom rejected that, wouldn't allow it. She went to Francis Parker here in Chicago. We pulled a clip here of Daryl Hannah discussing her difficult childhood in Chicago. She sat down with the CBS's Dan Rather and talked about this turning point in her life.
I wouldn't say I was introverted. I was more out there somewhere. I was off in the dream world all the time and was not very communicative. And in the 60s, they did like Rorschach tests and things. It wasn't very...
Literally.
It was like, here's an ink blot. What does that mean? And my answers were all wrong, apparently. And so they recommended to my mom to put me on some medications and institutionalize me, and I'm so thankful that she didn't, because I'd probably still be there today if she had. She took me out of school. She kind of just let me, sort of exist in my imaginary world for a good year or so, and sort of slowly reintegrated me back into the normal world, whatever that means.
Her stepfather, Jerry Wexler, a very well-known businessman in Chicago.
Yeah, but how about that? What a turnaround for her, and a remarkable story for sure.
Let's talk about Walter Payton's Super Bowl ring. And I had completely forgotten about this story, but it's quite a crime story, isn't it?
You know, I did too, Bob. I was going to ask you about that, if you remember this. Walter Payton, this week in 1996, lost his Super Bowl ring. He actually didn't lose it. He had given it to a high school student, a local high school student, who he entrusted with it, and that kid lost it. Walter was volunteering as an assistant coach for the basketball team in Hoffman Estates, and when all the teammates were gathered around, they were asking about his ring, they were holding it, they were just enamored by it, and he allowed one of those students to take it home with him. Big mistake. It ended up at a party in the kid's basement. It went missing. No one knew where it went. Unbeknownst to everyone at the party, it ended up in a couch that was then given to a family friend, the kid Phil Hong, who went to college in Indiana. And it was a few years before Phil was searching around, apparently, for his dog's toy that got stuck wedged in between the cushions. And he found Walter Payton's Super Bowl ring. And Walter Payton was his hero. So he was just like out of his mind. Unfortunately, at that point, Walter was no longer with us, but he managed to track down Connie Payton. And we pulled a clip here of Connie, along with her daughter, Brittany, telling some of this unbelievable story.
He actually let some kids at Hoffman Estates High School.
He was one of their honorary basketball coaches.
Yes, they were getting ready to go downstate, and they hadn't been in years and years and years. And as a token of letting them know how much he believed in them and that they could really go down and win and do a great job, he let them hold on to the Super Bowl ring. So somewhere in the interim, the ring got lost. The sofa that it was lost in, which they had searched at that time, but had been passed around from one friend, from family members to friends, of friends of that family to the next. And this young man was actually a student at Purdue University, and dog was digging for something at the sofa, the lining, and all of a sudden he pulled the lining out and this ring fell. And his name was Philip, and he was actually very nice to really call the family because he knew the history of it and how they had searched and how bad they felt, and called and said he found the ring and returned the ring.
And I like that happy ending, huh?
Yeah, he said his only regret was that he didn't find it sooner and could have given it to Payton while he was still alive. But Connie made him feel good and said that Payton had already had a replica made, and now each kid would have one. And so it was all good. It was all
good.
Yes.
Some indie history now. Anna?
Yeah, Bob, so this was a life-changing week for indie race car driver Danica Patrick. In 2002, she signed her first contract to drive professionally this week. Now, Danica was born in Wisconsin, many listeners will note, but she spent a lot of time in Chicago and has lived in Chicago for many years. And she's also a Bears fan, so we claim her for sure. This week, 2002, she signed with Bobby Rahal and David Letterman Racing. They've been teamed up in racing for years, still are. And this week, they offered her a multi-year deal to race for them. Danica Patrick said, "I owe them a lot. Outside of my family, they're the ones who believed in me most." And at the time, she was an underemployed 19-year-old road racer with big dreams, and she met Bobby Rahal at a course in Wisconsin. And that's when she got her big break. She called it like a huge break, but also one of the most high pressure moments of her life, because here she was getting so much pressure for being a woman, and she wanted to perform and be really, really great. But she went on to earn that credibility, I think, as a racer, it's fair to say. Here she is. We pulled a clip I think you'll like, Bob. The David Letterman Show, a few years later, one of the key people who ultimately helped her succeed.
When I do reflect a little bit, it's amazing. I went to my local go-kart track 2 weeks ago when we were racing at Chicago. The week before, I stayed home, which was really nice. And I went out there to Sugar River Raceway and saw all the kids out there. And it was like, wow, I've come a long way. And I told them, you know, I went out and stood on the track and said, "One of you guys is an IndyCar driver." You know, that's just really neat.
That's where it all began for you. And how old were you when you first started driving go-karts there?
Ten years old. I promote these products, you know, mortgage companies, TVs, you know, car part things, you know, windshield wipers, and you know, but the makeup and the hair haven't been called.
All right, we'll try and get you a shampoo. But don't feel bad. The shampoo people are not calling me either.
I think she did all right. Bit of sports history this week in 2009, Jonathan Taves, big night, right?
Big night for Jonathan Taves, 2009. The Hawks, playing for the Hawks, of course. He was in his second year with the Hawks. He was now team captain, and he scored his first hat trick, Bob. Just an incredible moment. And some Blackhawks fans will remember this because he not only scored three goals, he scored four goals. One of them was called back. So there were all these celebrations when he scored the third goal, and lots of people were throwing their hats on the ice, as is tradition, and people that you see was going crazy, it was going wild, but then they called it back, and they're like, wait a minute, that's not a hat trick. But he scored another one, so we pulled some of the unbelievable call from that unbelievable game.
Oh, they score! Tipped in front of the goal that appeared, it might have been Taves on a long blast from Barker. Wisniewski back door. Oh, Taves hit another pass and scored! Jonathan Taves. Barker a long shot. He scores!
Puck was touched by a high stick.
Yep.
Above the crossbar. No goal.
Barker centered one. A shot. They score. What a pass by Barker. And that is the hat trick for Jonathan Taves. This one will count. And back down to the ice come the helmet. He put the puck into the goal for his fourth time. Only three have counted. And you see the delirious Blackhawk fans who are now helmetless.
Yeah, it seems like a long time ago. Those were the days. And finally, do we call this junk food history, Anna?
Well, the pizza puff, I don't know. Some people would call that a good meal. I'd have to ask Marianne to be sure. But the Il Taco Company, believe it or not, invented the pizza puff. 1976. This week was the first earliest advertisement we could find of the pizza puff. And it dates back to a Chicago company that started out as the Illinois Tamale Company. Still around today. Still selling the pizza puffs. If you want to order them, they deliver them to your door, Bob. They can deliver them right to your door. They have a food truck as well. Yeah, you never know. You could call them the OG, the original gangster pizza puff, but they call themselves the OPP, the original pizza puff. And, you know, it's out there available for you if you want one.
Easy way to eat pizza while you're driving. Thanks, Anna. We'll talk to you next Wednesday.